Hello and welcome to another instalment of History How. We're going fully medieval today, aren't we, Alina?
We are, because we've got Daniela Gonzalez, who is a medievalist, funnily enough. She's currently working at the Parliamentary Archives. She also helped start a lockdown library for medieval and early modern researchers, which I think is absolutely awesome. But today we are talking about Nicholas Bremba and the Merciless Parliament of 1388. Welcome, Daniela.
Hi, and thank you so much for having me here. I'm super looking forward to talking about Bremba, the Merciless Parliament, and a fantastic set of guild petitions that were crucial in this story.
This is really good. So we are medieval morons, the two of us, so we love hearing about this stuff. But I can't wait, because I was recently reading that actually, like, literally the whole of society is built on these relationships and these guilds and everything, and this is it all basically going to shit, isn't it?
Yeah, basically in London, 1380s London is a little bit crazy, and it's really characterised by factional politics, particularly between Nicholas Bremba and another man called John of Northampton, who is another key figure in the story of 1380s London. And I mean, they've both been described as sowers of discord. They have very different opinions. They implement very different reforms in the city of London. And this is where they clash, so much so that after Nicholas Bremba became mayor in 1383, though I should say that he was also mayor in 1378. When Nicholas Bremba became mayor in 1383, things really kicked off. And that actually ends up with John of Northampton in February 1384, kind of rising up against him, and John of Northampton ends up being arrested. He hasn't got, you know, he's not very lucky. He ends up on trial at Reading in August 1384, and he's then sent off and exiled from the city of London the following month. He's actually sent to Cornwall, and I'm going to butcher this pronunciation. I think it's Tintagel or Tintagel Castle, and he stays there until about 1390.
Wow. Okay, before we get into the nuts and bolts of why this happened, can you tell us a bit about what London looks like in the 1380s? I'm guessing smaller than we know it now.
Yeah, definitely. I have to say, I didn't look so much at London's geography, though there are some fantastic images. There's a really cool image of London what's it called? In Matthew Paris's text. There's another really cool image, actually, that if you go on my Twitter page, it's a really amazing image of London in the 15th century. So do have a look at that. But what I will say with London is, London as we know it now, as you said, is obviously really big. But at this point in time, it didn't include Southwark and it didn't include Westminster. Perhaps calling them suburbs of London is not the correct terminology to use, but they didn't actually form part of a city. They were outside the city walls at this point. And it's much later in the early modern period when you see far more urbanization taking place and London really, really expanding.
Tell us, what was the Merciless Parliament and why did it take place?
So the Merciless Parliament is a parliament that started on the 3rd of February 1388. And the reason that the Merciless Parliament occurred was because there were a group of nobles that we know as the Lords Appellant, and these included Edward of Woodstock, the Duke of Gloucester, Richard Fitzalan, Earl of Arundel, Thomas de Beauchamp, Earl of Warwick, Thomas Mowbray, Earl of Nottingham, and a character that we all recognise, Henry Bolingbroke, Earl of Derby, who later becomes Henry IV, and they complained to Richard that he has several corrupt advisors, and really it goes back to the wonderful Parliament of 1386, when Michael de la Pole, who is Duke of Suffolk and he's also Chancellor at the time, he is accused of using his office and engaging in corrupt practices, and basically this kicks off a lot of trouble. He asks for extra taxation during this parliament, and the Commons ask for his impeachment. Now, this sets off a variety of events where Richard II, who's king at this time, gets really annoyed. He ends up going north once a set of commissioners have been put in place. And they're in place until the 10th of November, 1387. And this is when Richard comes back to London. The Council of Commissioners term, it expires. There's then a conflict at Radcot Bridge. And the appellants, who I mentioned before, they communicate with Richard II, who is in the Tower at this point, and they're like, right, we're not tolerating this corruption anymore. We're putting 5 characters on trial for encroaching the royal power, and these 5 are Michael Delapole, the Chancellor himself, Robert Tresilian, who is Chief Justice of the King's Bench, Alexander Neville, who is the Archbishop of York, Robert de Vere, who is Duke of Ireland, and Nicholas Bremer, who was Mayor of London until 1386. So he's there for 3 years.
So what do we know about Nicholas Bremer before he sort of summoned for this court proceeding?
Right, so Nicholas Bremer is actually a really prominent figure that comes out in the civic records of medieval London, and you'll find him in the plea and memoranda rolls. You'll find him mentioned in London Letterbook H, and those two primary sources are kept at London Metropolitan Archives. You can see them in person, and there are also editions of them if anybody does want to check them out. But you also see him mentioned in various chronicles, and he also features in proclamations that are issued during his term of mayor. And really, kind of what my understanding of Nicholas Bremer and the way that I examined him was, he actually faces a lot of difficulties during his time of mayor. He reverses lots of the reforms that John of Northampton put in place when John of Northampton himself was mayor earlier in the 1380s. And really, Nicholas Bremer is a person who has been characterised as looking out for his own people. He really looks out for the Company of Grocers, which is the company he belongs to. He monopolises the wool trade, and he really looks out for other people who are victuallers. So John of Northampton, when he was mayor, passed a statute in 1382, which basically said that if you were a victualler, so somebody who sells foodstuffs, you couldn't have judicial office. You couldn't hold judicial office if you were carrying on with your trade. And Nicholas Bremer basically reverses everything that Northampton does. He you know, his reforms, the way he governs London, is completely different. And he's basically the antithesis of Northampton. Northampton was personified as this person who, you know, he's a man of the people, and someone who, you know, yes, he uses the, he pleads to the king, he makes use of that power, but he really comes across as somebody who was looking out for the interests of all Londoners despite their ranks. And Nicholas Bremer really doesn't come off in that way. And what we can see from the documentary evidence is someone who consistently during his time as mayor tries to implement his authority time and time again. We see a lot of documents that actually highlight his anxieties as well. So he issues a set of proclamations that basically try to silence people. They try to put people in place, saying you can't form any kind of malicious assemblies against me, you can't speak any seditious words. So he's someone who really, I think, is facing a lot of difficulties in 1380s London. Lots of people don't like him. And obviously this ends up exploding in the Merciless Parliament of 1388. And I will give a bit of a spoiler. Nicholas Bremer is not lucky whatsoever, and he gets his head chopped off in February 1388 for being found guilty of encroaching the king's power and just being generally corrupt.
Well, you talked about how Northampton's seen as the man of the people. Bremer, not so much. But there's a lot of discontent during these years, especially in regards to the way that he was elected Mayor of London. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. And this, again, comes out so much in the petitions that I'll discuss in a little bit more detail later. But what we see from the records and the petitions is that the way that he became mayor in 1383, and no surprise, he stood against John of Northampton at this time, who obviously didn't get re-elected as mayor. So the way that his election is described is that Bremer had an armed mob and used that as a form of intimidation against people from craft guilds who would have been present. And very similarly, later in 1384, when he stands again for re-election as mayor, he stands against a man called Nicholas Twyford, who himself is a goldsmith, so he's a member of the craft or artisanal guilds. And yet again, he takes away the rights of the artisans of any crafts. He says that only the people who he has summoned can be present at the election. And that goes very much against kind of customs and traditional practices. So what he basically ends up doing in 1384 is taking away their voice, taking away their right to challenge him. So basically, overall, there is consensus within these petitions that no, he's done this in a really corrupt way. Like, this isn't on. He's moved away from the way that you should be governing London, and you should be implementing these practices within these institutions, particularly if you think about the fact that the elections are held at the Guildhall. Now, the Guildhall stands as a place of justice, of law, of fairness. That's where London governance comes out of. And Bremer is basically subverting that. And this is very much the representation that we do get in these petitions, and it is a complaint that's put forward, and it's also linked to the fact that Bremer was able to do that in a corrupt manner, because he encroached the king's power, which basically means he abused the king's power. He used kingly power in order to carry out this deviance and these misdeeds.
I think, before we crack on, I just, for the people, because we have a lot of listeners in America, just briefly tell people what the guilds are, why they're so powerful, and why it's a bad idea to piss them off at this point in London's history.
Cool. So I will, so you do have basically the kind of more like merchant guilds, so grocers, people who work in wool, fishmongers, and fishmongers and grocers are very historic guilds, but you also do have the artisanal guilds. Now, one thing that I will point out is you do have very, very powerful guilds, as you've said. So you've got the mercers and the goldsmiths, for example, and they're really influential at this point in time. The goldsmiths, for example, their own individual, so as well as the Guildhall, you've kind of got own individual guilds. And the Guildhall for the goldsmiths really did serve as a kind of political hub, almost a place that you could come and debate and challenge and talk about Northampton's reforms, for example. But you do also get kind of less wealthy guilds. So you get the kind of pinners, the painters, but nevertheless, as you do see in the petitions, they join the wealthier guilds and rise up.
So this is basically you go and join the one that represents your profession, and this is, they're London's power brokers, aren't they? These groups.
Yeah, essentially, definitely the mercers and the goldsmiths. And when you join as an apprentice, and then once you qualify, you'd be a full craftsman. I would say it's really important to be a part of these guilds as well, because that earns you kind of freedom and liberties of the city of London. So you get certain privileges with that.
So basically it's a union in layman's terms.
Yeah, kind of in a way. I mean, I don't know as much about this side of things, but you also get fraternities in this era, and parish guilds. And in fraternities, you'd have members, but they'd cross over from different guilds. I didn't really look into it, but if you look at a set of sources which were produced in 1389, which I think are called the Guild Returns, that would shed more light on their practices.
So what's really important is that basically if you crap on one of these guilds, you're essentially undermining the integrity of these professions, because this is, like you say, they go in as apprentices, then you become a member, it's like your union, but they're prestigious as well, aren't they? And it's very much like they're going to want to safeguard their authority, but in the meantime, Nicholas Bremer's trying to do that for himself, isn't he? Doesn't he issue a lot of silly proclamations that you read them and they're not really even about power? You can just see his insecurities written all over them.
Yeah, so he does issue a various proclamations, actually, between 1384 and 1386. So he does try to legitimate his own authority. So as I was saying before, he says, oh, you can't speak badly about me. You can't do this. You can't form these malicious gatherings. And a word that you see come out time and time again is covens. So he's using set terms that carry like certain connotations that people would be familiar with. And it really is that kind of balance of, yes, we see him trying to implement his authority throughout, but actually, why would you have to repeatedly issue these if you had that authority and it was established? So I was so interested in seeing what they told me about the insecurities he would have felt at this point in time. So they've got that almost, I guess it's almost like a paradox, really, and they've got like that dualness to them. I mean, it's so interesting because you also get a much later proclamation in 1387 that's issued on the king's behalf, but it basically is about, well, you can't speak badly about me, the king, and you can't speak badly about the queen, and you can't speak badly about my advisors, which of course would include at this time Nicholas Bremba. I mean, Nicholas Bremba had very close links with Richard II. I mean, even during the Merciless Parliament itself, Richard really tries to fight his corner. It's present in the Westminster Chronicle, who outlines that Richard is like, oh, Bremba is not corrupt, he's fine, and he really tries to fight his corner. But there is one scholar who even goes as far as to say that Richard II ends up being like a liability for Nicholas Bremba.
This is the thing, isn't it? Richard II, you're thinking, oh, support of the king, but Richard II is a major dud in terms of Britain's kings and queens, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think the circumstances around Richard II's reign are, I do think a lot of it does come down to circumstance. Remember, he does come to the throne as a minor.
Yeah.
And that in itself presents problems. And there are times in his reign when Richard really comes across as demonstrating these kingly values. I mean, in 1381, when I believe he's 14 at the time, he comes out and he meets the rebels who took part in the peasants' revolt, and he displays, you know, this kingly charm, this charisma, what a king should do. But also, he's very petulant. He's a very turbulent character. He has mood swings, and what you end up seeing later in the 1390s, and this is so interesting if we're thinking about some of the rhetoric and terminology used in the Merciless Parliament. So I mentioned encroaching royal power earlier. And that's a term that doesn't come out very often in the Parliament rolls. I think a rule for Richard's reign, it comes out 50-something times. I mean, 35 times it's mentioned just during the Merciless Parliament. But Richard actually then turns around in 1397 and accuses three of the Lord's appellants, I think it's Warwick, Gloucester and Arundel, of encroaching royal power themselves. And this is basically, it's been suggested by a historian called Alan Rogers that he basically turns around and he's like, this is revenge for what you did to me in 1388. Like, how dare you? So we do see him displaying, yeah, this very kind of turbulent, very petty, catty behaviour at points in his reign.
Alex might shoot me in a second for asking this question, and I really need to ask this question so badly. Right, so the running joke it is a running joke, but it's actually deadly true. I can't tell my kings from kings in history at all, and I'm about to ask the stupidest question in the world. Please penalise me. Right, we are not talking about Richard the Lionheart, are we?
No. So Richard the Lionheart is much earlier. He's number one. And okay, then you get Richard II and then Richard III later, towards the end of the Wars of the Roses. So the Richard III who supposedly kills the princes in the tower. It is really confusing though.
It is confusing. And even I'm not that good with medieval kings either. But Richard II is another one, like Richard III, who gets worked over by Shakespeare, isn't he? So we should be careful about a perception of Richard II, because like Richard III, Shakespeare screwed him royally, didn't he?
Exactly. And I mean, Richard, the history play on Richard III, I find absolutely fascinating. I wrote about it for my undergraduate dissertation. And when Shakespeare writes the history plays, I believe it's in the 1390s. Sorry, I'm getting confused with dates myself. It's in the 1590s towards the end of Elizabeth's reign. And this is kind of what John Guy has characterized as this like nasty 90s when Elizabeth, you know, there's like, there's famine, there's like war with Ireland. There's like a rebellion in like, I think it's 1601. And you know, Elizabeth is really known for her golden age, but the 1590s aren't that great for Elizabeth. And when he writes Richard III, I mean, one of the arguments that I made and the way that the play ends, it's so cleverly done by Shakespeare, where he ends the play basically saying, and the House of Lancaster and the House of York came together and they basically fixed all the problems of the Wars of the Roses. And yeah, Richard III really doesn't get like a good time in that play at all. He really is presented as that kind of evil king who murdered his nephews, who had malicious intentions. And again, we get that kind of that really kind of stereotyped image of Richard as like that hunchback. So yeah, Shakespeare is not nice to him at all, and I do think we'd have to take the history plays with a pinch of salt, as it's kind of, yeah, it's the story of the Wars of the Roses, and it leads up to that moment at the end of the play Richard III.
It's like someone in 200 years' time watching the Tudors and taking it as historical fact, isn't it?
Oh, God, yeah, and you should never do that.
So let's go back to Nicholas Bremba. You've mentioned a term a few times. Let's explain it to people a bit better. Encroaching the king's power. This is like a catch-all in medieval times, isn't it, for anyone that's got too big for their boots.
Yeah, and like Nicholas Bremba, the way he's presented in the petitions, in the parliament rolls, and even in a source known as Thomas Favant's pamphlet, is this kind of stereotyped evil counsellor that you get time and time again in the medieval period, and also in the early modern period. It does come out a lot in some Henry VIII rebellions and much later. But basically, he's seen as this man who has abused the king's power, and that's basically what encroaching the king's power is. It's almost like taking the king's power and you exercising it yourself. Now, the mayor of London's a really significant figure because it's almost like being the king in London. And something that's really great about London is whenever you get a new king, the king issues the city of London like a charter saying, yeah, like your mayor's like in charge, and I authorize him with his power to govern London. But yeah, encroaching royal power is one of these things where taking the king's power becomes, it's treasonous. Now, really kind of significantly and curiously, the term isn't included in the 1352, I think it's Statute for Treason or Treason Act. But at this point in time, they're like, no, like you have committed treason against the king. That is why it is so bad. That is why they're like, no, we want them on trial in parliament, and parliament at this time is the right place to do that rather than kind of the other courts. So Court of Exchequer, well, as it was known, Exchequer of Pleas, or Court of King's Bench. And basically, yeah, they're like, no, like you've done the worst possible thing against the king, you know, that is possible. And one of the things that I found so interesting when conducting my research was looking at the ideas of medieval political theory and placing encroaching the king's power within that context. Because the king himself is meant to be the head of society. So imagine the king as the head, and then you've got the rest of the body, and you know, somebody makes up the other limbs, like the arms, the legs, the fingers, the toes. So if Bremba is subverting the head, everything else comes falling down with it, and everything else is what forms the body politic that the king is meant to look after. That's what makes a good medieval king, someone who stamps out evil counsellors and looks after his people. And the way that Bremba's presented in the parliament rolls, in the petitions, is someone who doesn't allow the king to do that. So by encroaching the king's power, what he's doing is having a detrimental effect on the kingdom, but also London more specifically.
The Lords Appellant, they recruit the artisanal guilds of London, don't they, to go after Nicholas Bremba?
They do. So they have a meeting of them on the 18th of January 1388, so just before the Merciless Parliament starts on the 3rd of February. And they basically have a chat with them and basically ask them for their support. Now, it depends what sources you look at. that tell us kind of about how key they were or the vital role they play. I mean, if you look at the Westminster Chronicle, he kind of plays it off and he doesn't really give them much significance. But if you look at Thomas Favant's pamphlet, Thomas Favant is like, oh my God, they were so key. Like they made such a large contribution to bringing Nicholas Bremba down. I mean, one of the things that you might think of Thomas Favant's pamphlet, then it is partisan, and this very much comes into it, but there is an argument that it was made for Nicholas, and the audience was Nicholas Twyford, who himself was a goldsmith, who had been slighted by Bremba. Remember I said he stood against Bremba in the 1384 mayoral election. He lost. He also doesn't really like Nicholas Bremba because in 1378, Nicholas Twyford was sheriff and then Nicholas Bremba also took that away from him.
I love this. Is basically a whole career of people he's hacked off have suddenly been given a license to get their own back, isn't it?
Basically, yeah. And I mean, Nicholas Twyford is clearly not happy. And again, one of the curious things is a lot of debate about which is the first petition made, because they're really similar. Like when you look at them together and you go for the transcription and you go for the translation, they all have their own little, you know, intricacies and quirks and you know, they really make the petitions their own, but there's so much overlap in structure, in wording. And there was someone who wrote a PhD a few years ago called Rob Ellis, who wrote a really compelling argument debating, you know, stating that the goldsmith's petition was the very first one made. So if it is the first one made, it's not really surprising because that was Nicholas Twyford's guild.
Okay, so these petitions that the artisanal guilds put together, they're individual documents, aren't they, from these little political hubs. There's 15 altogether. Tell us about some of them. What are their beefs with Bremba and how do they make him sound as bad as possible?
Oh, and trust me, they do it very well. So, yeah, as you said, there are 15 petitions. They're submitted by 19 guilds. Some of them submit them individually. And some of them submit them together. So you get like the leather sellers and the witteriers writing a joint petition. And that's I think the reason for that is because they both deal with like leather. Equally, you get the cutlers. Oh, gosh, this is a very long petition, so I might end up missing out a guild. But the cutlers, the bowers, the spurriers, the fletchers and the bladesmiths, they all work in metal. So they submitted a petition together. And again, like I said earlier, you do really get a mix of kind of wealthier guilds like the mercers and the goldsmiths and less wealthy guilds such as the pinners, the painters. Actually, curiously enough, so the mercers, which is one of the big guilds, their petition is in English. There is what's called the Anglo-Norman mercers petition. Yeah, and it's fascinating. It's the only one out of the 15 that is written in English at this time. And I think that especially at this point in time, if you're writing something in English, you want it widely understood. And it, in a way, it becomes almost more politicized. Mm. They're such fascinating documents because normally when you get medieval petitions and these would have been presented, for example, not just to Parliament, but the Court of Chancery, the Exchequer of Pleas, normally they're only a paragraph long, whereas these are really kind of in a hybridized format. They're several paragraphs. They're massive, massive records. Like I don't have a picture here to show you, but I'd love to show you just how amazingly long they are. Honestly, they stood out so much to me when I first looked at them. I was like, this is so weird. Like, why is this so long? Like, but they're really clever. They adapt this petitionary diplomatic to put across their views. And petitions are this excellent opportunity to get an insight into social concerns, political concerns, and what people kind of lower down the social scale like have to say. I mean, one of the fascinating things about these petitions is they're written within the individual guild halls. Petitions, normally you'd have a professional clerk or scribe writing them within the kind of, I guess, court area or parliament, what have you. And some of the complaints that they make against Bremba, and again, like I said, they're all really similar. There's a lot of uniform complaints. So they complain about his unjust election at the Guildhall, how he becomes mayor. They make reference to an incident that occurred in Cheapside in 1384, specifically February. 1384. They also talk, actually, to be fair, not all of them mention this, about eight petitions bring up a book that's called the Jubilee Book. And that was a book that was written following the Good Parliament of 1376 that sought out to reform the city and to move more towards the idea of the common good or the common profit, which basically is like the well-being of everyone. I mean, they have a great time saying, yeah, Bremba's worked against these, you know, this book is now destroyed because of Nicholas Exton, who has close links to Nicholas Bremba. They've destroyed the true articles of civic governance. Like, how dare they? And I mean, other ones, like, I will bring in kind of, yeah, things that are relevant to their own guilds. So I'm going to jump back to what I said about Cheapside. So the Cordwainers and the Saddlers mention what happens at Cheapside. And this actually takes place a few days after John of Northampton rises up against Nicholas Bremba on the 7th of February. This incident at Cheapside takes place on the 11th. And there is this man called John Constantine, or Constantine, or never know how to pronounce it. I'm probably pronouncing it incorrectly. But he ends up being executed. He gets beheaded during this incident by those on Nicholas Bremba's side. And the Cordwainers are like, how dare you? You've done this against our guild. Like, he was a Cordwainer. And so it's immediately like an affront against them. Now, the Saddlers also mention John Constantine. And that's because the Saddlers and the Cordwainers work together very, very closely. I mean, other guilds like the Goldsmiths mentioned some of their own members. So one individual who they mention is Richard Murden, who gets imprisoned. And very unfortunately, I know I said that the Goldsmiths petition is potentially the first one that went round, but it's actually quite fragile and there are bits missing. So because of the damage on the document, I can't read the other names, which is really annoying. But yeah, it's good I could get like Richard Murden and talk a little bit about how, again, that is another direct affront against the Goldsmiths, particularly. And they, you know, they really put this in the London context. They really make the petitions their own. You know, they're really well thought out. They highlight that Bremba's worked against their, not just their reputation, and you know, he's not just brought about their detriment, but he's brought about the detriment of London, Londoners more widely. Some petitions mention not just other mysteries and guilds, but workers in the city. So you might think, yeah, of course they're giving in these petitions because they've suffered at the hands of Bremba. Bremba like reversed loads of reforms that Northampton implemented that would have benefited them. But you do have to give it to them. They're so clever in the way that they do this. They're like, oh yeah, we've lost out, but so has the rest of London. And one of the things that's so interesting and I think is done so well is that at no point do they make any offence to Richard II. They do say, okay, yeah, your power's been encroached, like this should be done for king and for crown, and the law should be stuck to. But I think they do realise they need to be very kind of...
It's smart. It's like, yeah, we're only thinking of you, dear King Richard, rather than sort of implicating him in any of this. Can I ask, you have studied pretty much everything you can find on Nicholas Bremba. Do you think, what's your hunch, did he give a crap when he was like climbing his way to the top? Or was he just hapless and he just managed to annoy everybody on the way up?
That's such a good question. I mean,
just an opinion. And as a historian, it's like, no, I can't answer this. I can't answer this. Just your opinion, your hunch. What do you think? Oh, is he just a knob, or is he like, do you think, did you even realise you were doing this at the time?
I think he's a man definitely after power. I mean, that's why you make links with the king. You forge those links. I mean, I'm going to bring John of Northampton back into this. He forged links with John of Gaunt, who initially didn't support him, but John of Gaunt saw this political opportunity and he was like, I'm going to get in there and join this, because there is a lot of tension anyway between John of Gaunt and Richard II. I think Nicholas Bremba, it's a very unfortunate end. I do think he was a bit hapless, and I think it's really telling that by 1387, loads of his supporters are kind of abandoning him. They know that he's in a bad position. They know he's made mistakes. I think a lot of it is circumstantial, but I do think he played a bad hand of cards.
And it doesn't end well for him. So tell everybody what happens. You already mentioned he gets his head cut off. So what do they find at this merciless parliament? And also as well, what does it mean for Richard II?
So they basically find Nicholas Bremba guilty. He's unlucky and he stands on trial on the 17th of February and then gets the chop on the 20th. So bye-bye, Nicholas Bremba.
It's pretty quick.
It is, yeah. It's a very, very quick turnaround. But what I will say is also associates of Nicholas Bremba also get the chop. So there is a man called Thomas Usk, who people will know for having written his appeal against John of Northampton. Now, Thomas Usk is such a political opportunist. He actually starts off in John of Northampton's party. And then when he realises that things are going south for John of Northampton and actually Usk ends up imprisoned anyway, he joins Nicholas Bremba's party in 1384-ish. But yeah, bad move for him because he ends up executed as well. Now, in terms of Richard II, I think 1388 for Richard is a watershed moment. I think it must have been quite scary for him, actually, in terms of the appellants coming forward, making these accusations, kind of taking over, really. And I think Richard really wakes up in terms of, oh my God, I need to be king. Like, I need to put down my authority. So I do think 1388 in that way is a big wake-up call for him. And we do see in the 1390s that he really has his own idea of who he is as king, what it means to be king. And you really see these exalted ideas of his own kingship, how he himself conceptualizes that and understands it in the Wilton Diptych, which is kept at the National Gallery and which I am absolutely dying to see in person again. Fingers crossed it like opens up soon.
Okay. The people of London, this is a seismic event in the history of London, isn't it? And for the people of London at the time, tell us to what extent they're just fed up with both of these guys by the time you get to 1391.
So the best example that I have of this, and I thought it was such a good find when I was doing my research, I was like, oh yes, this is awesome. I can like link it back to Bremba Northampton and this idea of common profit. So the idea of common profit, as I said before, which is the idea that you act for the well-being of everyone, was really central in the research that I carried out. And I tried to really place the language that I was looking at and the records I was looking at within this kind of context and how common profit rhetoric links up with governance. But in carrying out my research, I found this proclamation dating to 1391, and it's issued under the then mayor of London, who is a different person called Adam Bam. Basically, what the proclamation says is, nobody can speak about this dispute between Northampton and Bremba. Like, it causes loads of dissension, it causes riot, it causes problem. So everybody just stop. We're fed up with this. We don't want to hear about this. Bringing this up and causing these problems means you're working against the good of the community of London. You're working against us being able to establish the common good and work towards that. And to be honest, I really do. I do think they're fed up by this point, and so much so that I think what you end up seeing in the 15th century, at least in the early 15th century, you don't really see problems like you see in the 1380s. And I think by this point they've really learnt their lesson. They're like, oh my gosh, this awful stuff happened, like there's so much turbulence, we're all so fed up of this. And 1380s basically serves as a lesson to those ruling much later on and allows them to work towards a common good and implement these ideas.
It's been brilliant. Thank you so much for coming on to give us just a little insight into just a snapshot of London's history. And I just love that we all think our politicians now are the most inept, corrupt idiots there are. But no, it has always been this way.
It is. I will say that my dad, my dad read my entire PhD and he would text me and he's like, this sounds really familiar. I was like, oh yes. Oh yes, it does.
It absolutely does. Before you go, tell us about this lockdown library.
Oh, excellent. So MemsLib was created by myself and some other postgraduates at the Centre for Medieval and Early Modern Studies at the University of Kent. It's online at www.memslib.co.uk if you'd like to access it. And what it is basically an online platform that is filled with mainly online resources for medieval and early modern studies. There are pages dedicated to to the study of manuscripts and codicology. There's a section there for paleography. We have a page on Islamic studies, a page for early modern and medieval history, early modern literature and history as well, early modern drama. And so there's a little bit of something for everyone. There's also links to theological texts if you're interested in studying medieval religion or the Reformation. There's also a really good forum that you can use. All you need to do is sign up as a member, and when you sign up as a member, it'll get approved by the now the committee who now run MemsLib. And you can use that forum to ask questions, to ask for resources. There was also a recent addition that the previous team that I was part of, where you can put up call for papers for conferences that you're either organising or that you've seen. And I mean, if you have a resource that you would like to be added that isn't there, just get in contact with the team. You can either send them a direct message on Twitter, which I'm sure that they're very happy to receive. And if you go on the website, you'll be able to find the contact details there to just drop them a line. They're always really happy to answer any questions. So yeah, if you're a medievalist or early modernist and you know you can't get to your libraries, you can't get to archives, you're having some trouble, definitely check out MemsLib, because it's got a fantastic set of resources that you can use. And you don't have to be, I will emphasize this, you don't have to sign up as a member to use the resources. All the links are there and they're all free. Some aren't open access, but there will be a label next to the source to say whether you need university access for that particular one.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. What a great resource. Far more constructive than Alina and I in our lockdown efforts, just waffling at people. Brilliant. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. And thank you so much for having me. I'd love to come back and talk more about medieval London, kingship, the other sources I looked at. It's been absolutely great. So thank you so much.
Deal.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hack history, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.